And now, for the thousands in attendance and the millions of people that wish they were sitting in front of my bar at the moment, welcome to the 12th episode of At The Bar with Yo Adrian, where I explore the lives and times of some really interesting people. And one of those interesting people happens to be sitting opposite me at the moment. She is the former head of wellbeing at South Sydney Rabbitohs, psychiatric nurse, and now trained counsellor, Jan Earle. Good morning, Jan.
Good morning, Adrian. Very grateful that you've got me on your podcast and hope that I can answer some informative education about mental health.
Well, I'm very grateful to have you, Jan.
Thank you.
And without any further ado, I've got a drink there for you.
Thank you.
And as you know, it's not compulsory, and you don't always have to have an alcoholic beverage. So I'm having the alcoholic beverage option.
Cheers, Adrian.
Cheers. Okay, let's get exploring the life and times of Miss Earle. I affectionately call you Jan Earle the Pearl because she normally shines like a pearl upon people that she meets.
Unfortunately, Adrian, pearls are for tears. They are lovely. I would like to say that I do like to help people and care for them as much as I can.
In my eyes, I love pearls, and you know what I think of you.
Thank you, Adrian.
My charm's still there, I think. Anyway, where did you grow up, Jan? And what did you want to do when you were a kid?
I grew up in Wellington, New Zealand, which is the capital city of New Zealand. I grew up in a place called Strathmore Park, which is near the airport. From an early age, my mother and grandmother had a great presence in my life about helping people. My mother succumbed to a severe motor vehicle accident at 18 years of age, and she had many years in hospital. And for that reason, I spent a lot of my early life in hospitals with my mother, seeing her have many operations and starting to go through a traumatic time in her life. She then went on to have my sister, and she also had stillborn twins. So I went through all of these experiences as an early age growing up. But I knew very early on, when my grandmother bought me a nursing uniform at age 7, that would be my destiny. At 10, I wanted to be a nun, but alas, I didn't get the light coming down and the calling. But I certainly wanted to be a nurse. And from that moment on, that's what I was going to do. And all my schooling was geared around having a nursing career and helping other people. And that's what I believe I'm here to do. And that's what I believe I will do till the day I die.
How did you get involved in the mental health industry?
Mental health sort of came secondary to me. I've always been a generalist nurse, aged care, surgical nursing, disability, across the board. And then as I got older, I started to really want to learn about mental health disorders. And in my own family, there's a strong history of addiction issues. So I was self-taught along the way, and then I started to learn more and more about it. The nursing industry changed very, very much. So at the time when I left nursing, my next step was going to be a counsellor or to be in some kind of well-being business where I could help others. I'm very interested in the plan, the assessment, and the case management of people to get the best outcome.
Right. How did you get that important job when you worked at South Sydney as a well-being person and then go on to work with elite athletes from other NRL clubs who needed help coping and healing from addiction issues, trauma and mental disorders? Covers a few things there.
The job as head of wellbeing at South Sydney doesn't define me. I was very lucky and very grateful to be given that job and to work with the great Cardinal and Myrtle young men and grade players, and indeed all the older, more established players that had left the game or transitioned out of the game into new careers. It was a great time. I learnt a lot. But once I'd done it, that was just another ring in my belt. I wanted to further my education more, which I did. And then I started Elite Athletes. My love of rugby league has been one since I was 4 years old. My own son plays rugby league, and a lot of my younger son's friends play rugby league. I love the lads. It's not that I'm a fan, because I'm certainly not. I want to go beyond seeing them as a fan. And when they succumb to pressure or need help, whether it be whatever, I'm there to help them. And I was very lucky to have that job. But Elite Athletes is now going through a different phase where we're rebranding, and we're eventually moving on into other areas of mental health. I'll always have my Elite Athletes program, and some of the athletes I've seen in the last 5 to 10 years, I will always see and always help and watch their careers, and certainly as they transition out. But my next phase of where I'm going and what I'm doing is very, very exciting.
My next question is, with 1 in 5 Australians experience a mental health episode every year, or 45% of Australians being affected by mental illness at some time in their life, they're incredible figures, very surprising to me also. Why do you believe it is becoming more prevalent now?
I think mental health is really coming to the fore now, and the help, the pathways, the public hospital system is full to capacity, and unless you're more aware or you're educated in where to go, how to seek help, and indeed get that best outcome for you, it's becoming harder and harder. In the professional world of mental health, it's very hard to find that therapeutic rapport, and you have to keep searching for someone that'll work for you, or definitely a plan that works for you. But the figures are certainly outstanding, and they're growing all the time. And cries for help are going unannounced. People aren't doing as much as they should, and sometimes it's very alarming for the general public and for us that work in mental health every day.
Yeah, look, my humble opinion on that, and I'm not an expert like you, is I believe society's becoming too competitive, and comparison always leads to disappointment, and that obviously leads to depression and generalized anxiety disorders, which is probably the most common mental disorder. And I'd say my personal advice is, you know, go at your own pace in your own lane without looking left to right. I just find that social media's has made us become too competitive now against each other. And we're always comparing. There's always going to be people better and less than you.
Well, I'm certainly not everybody's cup of tea, as I just alluded to, but for me personally, I think the pressure of life for young people today, i.e. with social media, definitely the competitiveness of who's going to be best, who's going to look the best, who's got the best, it's actually all-encompassing. And no wonder our younger children and our earlier adolescents are suffering from mental health from an early age. We are starting to intervene in the schools with many, many wellbeing education programs, which is great to see. But it's alarming. It's alarming that we haven't, in this day and age, got more to offer.
Do you reckon Australia is doing enough about mental health? The government's putting enough money in there at a state level?
Well, certainly from what I've seen in my visits to the hospitals and clinics, it certainly seems to be understaffed, undermanned, and definitely the wards are overflowing. And then it's the aftercare that needs to be managed more effectively as well, from adolescents right through to our elderly as well.
Because they've made it very difficult now to get NDIS. I mean, a lot of people were getting NDIS that probably didn't deserve it, and the people that deserve it.
I don't really want to comment too much on the NDIS because it's out of my control, but I think the sheer abuse that was made by people was so totally wrong and unacceptable. And
oh,
yes,
I agree. Yeah.
I've seen many a client be unable to get NDIS, and it's totally wrong. I'm not at the top there. I know that they are doing a lot of work to regulate the NDIS space, and it really needs to be regulated. The government has a great scheme in the carer allowance, the carer pension, and the carer gateway. But unless you're educated or know about these systems that are in place, it's hard. It's hard to find. It's hard to negotiate. But definitely the government, I feel, at a state level is really trying. It's just that it's becoming in such high demand for everyone at the moment.
What are some of the main impacts on mental health, especially between 18 and 25, where it affects 75% that age group? What are the main impacts do you find?
Definitely anxiety, the use of illicit drugs, inconsistent parenting, and ineffective communication in the home. I believe that's where it all starts. And as a mother of two sons, I'm probably guilty of any one of those things. But it's all about education. It's about sitting down, talking. We all know the family unit hardly ever sits down to dinner. We're all time poor. It starts with a simple question. We've all heard about, are you okay? But what about talking as a family, nutting it out together, knowing that they've always got somewhere, someone to turn to? As parents, we're all busy. In a single parent family, it's very hard. There's denial, there's acceptance of mental health, illicit drugs. And some parents just don't want to accept it. And that's not a criticism. That's because they don't know where to go or where to turn to. They're embarrassed. The remorse and shame and the stigma of mental health has to stop. It's real and it's out there.
And it is true that it doesn't discriminate mental illness. You could be the best parent in the world and you'll still have a child that may suffer from mental illness.
100%. And as a parent of someone with mental illness, sometimes it's not your parenting and you can't take it on board, but you so often just want the best for that child. You tend to give rather than take back, and sometimes they need to be able to control their behaviours in different ways, and it's hard as a parent to look at that effectively when it's their own child. There's some simple programs online, Triple P Parenting, Positive Parenting, Adolescent Parenting. They're all great, simple courses where you can start. And I recommend that every family in Australia should do mental health first aid so they have an understanding, a basic understanding of mental health.
That's good advice. What are the most common mental illness disorders that people like yourself have to deal with?
I deal a lot with performance issues, relationship issues, young people, adolescents with behavioural issues, and a lot of addiction. And I also work very much in the forensic world with people before the courts, whether it be traffic, whether it be domestic violence, or again, whether it be addiction. I don't judge anybody. Everyone's there for a reason. And I just try my best to do the best for that person on the day. And I certainly hope that my outcome will be that I have done my best and they are the best authentic person they can be.
What are some of the most complex mental illness disorders that you have to deal with? And tell us about your own wellness business that you've got.
So the most complex I would deal with would be borderline personality disorder, acute psychosis from illicit drugs, definitely any kind of addiction. It's the hardest thing anyone can go through in their lives, but there's a lot of help out there. And addiction, I've got a family history of addiction, and I just love my work around that. I love being involved in it, and I love helping people. But unfortunately, the mainstay of addiction is they have to be committed. They have to be accountable. I can't do it for them. My staff, we work in a holistic way where we believe that the family has a lot to do. If the family gets well, the addict gets well. Holistically, we like to work with the parents, we like to work with the addict, or anyone with a mental health illness. We like to get them assessed properly. We believe that psychiatric intervention is second to none.
Has it got to be early intervention?
Definitely early intervention. As soon as they ask for help, don't ignore it. It's a detailed assessment plan. And then from there, looking at that assessment plan, we case manage our clients. And definitely we're very lucky to work with one of Sydney's leading psychiatrists. I won't name him because I didn't ask him. But he's just a wonderful man, kind, caring, just really someone I would really advocate for. And I certainly know in my business he does a lot for my clients. And indeed my own team, they do a lot for our clients. It's client first and they're our clients. Doesn't matter how they are at the time, they're our clients and we've got to do our best for them.
You know, when you said that you need commitment from that person who's suffering from the mental illness, what happens if they're not in that frame of mind? How do you get them to commit and get them into that right frame of mind?
Again, it comes from intervention, assessment and management. Not all mental illnesses are going to be solved in 5, 10, 15 minutes. It's a process. Not all medication works the first time. Not all therapies don't work. But it's building that therapeutic rapport with the client. Whatever they're suffering from, building that therapeutic rapport. Knowing that you're there for them. I answer the phone 24/7. I have to, because my clients rely on me. Is that me having weak boundaries? No, because I always want to be there for my clients. If they need something, I'm there before it gets out of hand or becomes unmanageable.
Is medication improving all the time?
Medication is improving all the time. And knowledge of medications is improving all the time. Don't ever take a medication without getting a printout. Know your side effects. But of course, everyone doctor googles and believes they're going to get every single side effect. It's so damaging for the client's intervention. They need ask the pharmacist, ask your psychiatrist, ask your therapist. I'm feeling like this. Do your mood and sleep charts. All of these create a better assessment, better intervention. And often people say, oh, I've tried that, I've tried this, I've done that. No, I'm not taking this. No, I'm not taking that. Well, do your homework first, because it is trial and error, unfortunately. But trial and error may be, but eventually you'll find something that works.
And there's still a lot of people out there that are critical of medication. They say, oh, if you go on medication, you're going to be on it for the rest of your life. How much truth is in that?
Well, that's up to the individual. And I'm not here to cast a general diagnosis on that. But I really believe in medication therapy, along with cognitive behavioural training, whether it be DBT, whether it be any other intervention. I think medication plays a big part in the overall treatment plan.
Well, I've always told people, I say, look, I take blood pressure tablets, cholesterol tablets. So I resign to the fact that I'll be taking them for the rest of my life. And there's hardly any side effects. So it's a little bit like that. You're taking medication and you're going to... Because I think people get scared. They go, I've got to take this for the rest of my life. But if it's going to help you...
Well, I think it's fear of the unknown. And a lot of psychiatric medications need blood work, they need constant checking, and they also need that plan. That plan is so important, the regular psychiatric intervention. And you might say, oh, it's very hard to get into a psychiatrist. Well, if you really need to see a psychiatrist, you can. It does take time sometimes, especially in the adolescent space. But it's keeping up your appointments, keeping up those interventions that work for you.
The government's still allowing in New South Wales through Medicare that we're allowing at least a dozen visits to a psychologist.
With a mental health plan. I don't work in the government space. I work privately, so I'm not too sure. But I know there are other systems that you can utilise that do give you those free sessions, yes.
And do you reckon they are useful? seeing a psychologist as opposed to a psychiatrist, which will give...
Well,
legally can give you medication.
This is a good question because people really don't understand. A psychiatrist is the only person that can provide medication and give a diagnosis. A psychologist is there to work with the diagnosis and suggest and see through the plan that's been made by the psychiatrist. So there's no comparison. It's like a pathway.
Mm.
And again, what I've been told by a lot of clients is therapists today are time poor. They're looking at the clock. They're not getting the educational advice to back up things. But that's only what I've been told. In my practice, it's a bit different.
Yeah. Now, what signs would you look in a person that may need help? What are telltale signs?
I definitely look at change in mood, sleep, nutrition. Those are the three sort of key things, but I would look at if they'd had an environmental change, if they were transitioning from one job to another. There's a lot of problems in the workplace and what other stressors they're going through at that time. Unless it was an acute phase where they were really unable to manage it themselves, I would definitely go first of all with a detailed assessment.
So when you say acute, is that psychosis?
It could be a psychotic episode, or it could be just suicidal ideation. It could be any number of things. But when it's so acute, they should present to their nearest emergency unit. All hospitals have a mental health unit attached to them.
And of course, early intervention is always the best way to deal with that too.
Early intervention is key to everything.
What are the different types of treatment and supports that can help people with mental illness function better and aid in their recovery?
Well, again, it becomes with the assessment, the diagnosis, and the plan. But also it's about self-care. Really taking the onus back on you. Self-care. And that encompasses many things. Fitness, nutrition, communication, social, mental, physical. Look for a win every day in those fields. And then with that, a lot of people like spirituality. So all of those things really aid the mental health plan.
Yeah, I find just going to the gym, that boosts your self-esteem up.
Well, you definitely get that hit of dopamine when you're in the gym, and it can boost your self-esteem. But people who are long-term gym junkies, I like to say, or runners, or walking, it's all good for your mental health. Whatever floats your boat, do it.
But even now, there was talk about, I heard on the radio yesterday, scientists are looking into music, something that can boost one's self-esteem and make them feel better.
I love music, and funnily enough, I was in a meeting this morning, and someone told me that he performs once a week for dementia patients, and they mightn't be able to speak or have a level of conversation, but put on a song and they can remember the words. For me, I'm old, but I'm out there walking the pavement every day with my headphones on, listening to my 70s and 80s music. My feet get faster, my arms swing, and I feel on top of the world. But that's just me.
Yeah, it's the same with me when I listen to 80s.
Mm.
And I went to visit my father yesterday at the home, and he's in these last stages of vascular dementia. And as soon as I put Sinatra on, his eyes lit up and he actually said my name, which he hasn't said for a while. It was incredible. It's like, where'd that come from? So I think
it's
music
like
does
flicking that, a switch.
Yeah.
Really, it is.
And prior to that, I didn't get a word out of him for half an hour. So, yeah, it's incredible. Now, if you've got a crystal ball and you can look into the future, do you believe mental health illness disorders will be a thing of the past once there are advances in medication, psychotherapy, and other treatments such as TMS or ECT, etc.?
I think we'll keep learning. and we'll keep getting the best. There's a lot of research being done in mental health fields and clinical tests and surveys. And I think mental health is, okay, we're overloaded now, but I think the research that's being done is extremely valuable. A lot of our public hospitals do a lot of clinical research, and obviously it's out there on social media, but you don't hear about these things. But they are doing a lot. They're doing a lot to research all the time.
Now, perfect segue into how would you define happiness? Now, I asked this question to Dave Birchall, who I had on my last episode. He gave me a good answer. So it's interesting. Everyone's got their own little definition of happiness. What's your definition of happiness? How would you define it?
Being true to my core values. That's really important to me, my core values, and always working on my boundaries and being the best authentic person that I can be.
Great answer. Very good answer, in fact. Can you give us 5 tips to achieving that happiness that we're all craving for?
Time out, self-care. Those two are very important. You need to shut the door. You need to reflect. You need to look at how you can do things better. We're always looking for perfection, but that's not how it should be. It should be progress, not perfection. 3 tips there. Also, family, the connection. It's very, very important. We seem to be very agitated. We get annoyed quick. In these economic times, money's not always there. We can't provide. We can't get the best. We don't have to have the best. Go back to the simple things in life. Be happy.
So you reckon the family unit is very, very important for just general mental health?
I think the family unit, that's where it starts from. I come from a very dysfunctional family, but, you know, my mother, my sons, my grandmother, we were all extremely close. And those times I really remember and shaped my life, even though I didn't have a father in my life from a young age. But in my work, we always promote that because Dad is always tired. He's the provider. He doesn't always see what's really going on. And mothers try their best and they're all time poor. We have to sit down as a family and listen, educate, and really get into our children. Not tell them what's right from wrong, because today's generation doesn't like to be told. There's no finger pointing. There's no saying this, this, this. You've got to come from a place of love and respect. And that's how I always like to treat my clients, very much my adolescent clients. Come down to their level. Listen to them. And to date, we've had some very good outcomes.
So this is a question I've asked all my guests, and I want you to think about this question.
Yes.
And give me the best answer you can give me. You had divine power to change anything about yourself. What would it be, Jan?
Anything about myself.
Anything about yourself.
I have size 11 feet.
Yeah.
And I'm always telling people that annoy me, I'm going to put those size 11 feet where the sun doesn't shine. So probably anything that I'd like to change about myself. If you knew me before, I was 150 kilos. I'm now 73 kilos. It didn't just fall in my lap. It came from hard work and commitment.
Yeah.
And that weight and that what I was experiencing came from a lifetime of trauma. I didn't wake up one day and it was gone. I worked so hard on myself and my love of other people and caring for them. That's what made me stronger mentally, physically, spiritually. And I've been able to achieve nearly all my goals.
And you're also a very, very good mother. Mother of 2 boys?
You might say so. They mightn't.
Well,
I annoy the hell out of them.
They're very, very adjusted 2 young men. 2 very, very adjusted guys that I've had the pleasure of meeting. One was Sandor Ellen, used to play football for the, was it Storm?
Originally he started
He was on that Gladiator TV show too.
Yes, that's right.
So you've got the... Everyone will know you as the mother of one of the best-looking NRL footy stars. I think he took the title off Andrew Ettinghausen.
Well, that's very nice of you to say. I'd like to think he gets his looks from me, if we say so. Not the old Jan, maybe the new Jan. Look, looks don't define Shandor, but I have two sons.
And Ryan's also a really, really good MC.
Ryan is a wonderful young man. No two sons are the same.
Yep.
He's very academic. He's, you know, he's wise beyond his years. And I have Shandor, who's very entrepreneurial. But no two children are ever alike, and my two are very different. But I love them dearly. But this is their time now. They're in their 30s. I don't badger them. I'm not interested in their choice of partners unless it's more than 2 years. but I don't badger them, and they don't badger me. The washing comes in on a Friday, goes out on a Sunday. Shandor sends me messages, love you, Mum, but don't call me now. So this is the age we're in. But I don't get upset about it. Children are children. I have a great sister who is, I think, one of Sydney's best drug and alcohol counsellors, and we have a very strong relationship, and it's growing all the time since our dear mother passed. At the end of the day, family's family, and that's all we've got, and we've got to be there for each other.
So that means if Jan can change, which means I can change, which means you can change. So until next time, and I'll be saying forever and ever, don't take any shit from anybody. See you later.
Thank you, Adrian.